Good day and welcome to the American Constitution Society, What's Next? American Express and Access to Justice conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Mr. Zach Ema. Please go ahead.
Hi, I'd like to welcome everybody to today's call, What's Next? American Express and Access to Justice. My name is Zach Ema, and I'm an Assistant Director for Student Chapters at ACS. We're joined today by Arthur Bryant, and we could not have asked for a better speaker on this issue. Over the past 30 years, few attorneys, if any, have done more to preserve Americans' access to the civil justice system than Arthur. Arthur is the Executive Director of Public Justice, a national public interest law firm. He oversees all of public justice's litigation and its access to justice campaign, which fights in the Supreme Court and courts nationwide to preserve access to justice for all. This work included filing an amicus brief in the American Express case. Arthur has won major victories and established new precedents in several areas of the law, including access to justice, civil rights, class actions, constitutional law, consumer protection, mass torts, and toxic torts. He's been honored by, among others, the American Association for Justice, the American Bar Association, Harvard Law School, the Consumer Attorneys Association of Los Angeles, the Philadelphia Trial Lawyers Association, and the New Jersey Association for Justice. The Oregon Trial Lawyers Association has renamed its Public Service Award the Arthur H. Bryant Public Justice Award. He is a graduate of Swarthmore College and of Harvard Law. And with that, I'll turn it over to you, Arthur.
Thanks, Zach. One other claim to fame I have that few people know about is that Italian Colors Restaurant is actually in my neighborhood. And while I have no involvement in their bringing this lawsuit, it was sort of odd to realize that I was going to dinner at some place where all this was taking place. I understand the implications of what I'm supposed to be talking about is the implications of the American Express decision for access to justice. In a word, disastrous. For a little bit more, I urge you, beyond what I'm going to say in this call and what we're going to discuss, I urge you to check out a blog that I published the day of the decision, as well as an article I published in the National Law Journal. This was also on the National Law Journal site, preceding the decision, called A License to Steal. There was a question mark in front of that before the decision. There is really no question mark after the decision. And a blog posted by my colleague, Paul Bland at Public Justice on our website, www.publicjustice.net, entitled Worst U.S. Supreme Court Arbitration Decision Ever. To explain why we think this is so horrible and its implications for access to justice are so disastrous, and what's next, let me give you a little bit of context here. Without going into the lengthy history, over the last decade, the Supreme Court has been pushing and allowing corporations to push more and more cases into arbitration. Justified on a simple, single theory. And that is that the only difference from being into court as opposed to being in arbitration is that you're in a different venue. That is, you can go in court, which is costly and expensive and time-consuming, or you can go into arbitration, which is cheap and efficient and not complicated, simple. But the key difference in why it's okay to put you into arbitration and out of court is that you are not sacrificing your substantive rights when you do that. Court has repeatedly said over a series of cases that if putting you into arbitration would prevent you from, and their key phrase was, effectively vindicating your substantive rights, then the arbitration clause would not be enforceable. So this comes along in a context where corporations are putting arbitration clauses in more and more what they call agreements, but you know that none of us read. So all of us have in our credit card agreement, in our cell phone agreement, in almost every agreement where you click the terms and conditions on the web, an increasing number of agreements, an arbitration clause. And for years, those clauses just said, you agree that you will not sue us in court and instead you will go into arbitration. And the court increasingly has enforced those agreements. And then several years ago, they started to put in a separate clause into the arbitration agreement. But again, it was in the arbitration clause. It was not in a separate piece of the terms and conditions. And it said that you agree that you will not bring or participate in any class action or consolidated proceeding against us. You will only proceed in arbitration individually. Now, to be clear, if that clause was in a contract by itself, as a separate paragraph, I hereby agree I will not participate in a class action. Under most state laws and arguably even under federal law, those are not enforceable because they're making you give up your rights. But in a case, Concepcion, AT&T Mobility versus Concepcion a couple years ago, the Supreme Court held that California's rule, which said whenever an arbitration clause in a small dollar claim case alleging consumer fraud bans class actions, that arbitration clause, or more specifically the class action ban in that arbitration clause, is not enforceable because it's unconscionable under state law. And to be clear, California's law says it's unconscionable, unenforceable, whether it's in an arbitration clause or whether it's not in an arbitration clause. The rule is they can't stop you from going to court at, you know, by putting a class action ban in the contract. Well, in AT&T Mobility versus Concepcion, the Supreme Court held that California state law rule was preempted by the Federal Arbitration Act and was not enforceable. But it did not address the underlying theory of you could not effectively vindicate your rights if they enforced that clause because they said, well, in this particular case, the provisions that they have in the arbitration clause are so favorable to consumers, and the lower court decision says these particular consumers would be better off in arbitration than if they brought a class action, which brought us to Italian Colors. And so some people did claim after Concepcion, AT&T versus Concepcion, the Supreme Court had authorized corporations to wipe out class actions against them. And we said, no, they hadn't. They had not said any such thing. But to be clear, now they have. In American Express versus Italian Colors, what happened is Italian Colors, local restaurant, said, American Express has violated the antitrust clause by forcing us to accept all branded credit cards from American Express if we want to accept their premium card, and they've been overcharging us. And the allegations were, when the expert came in, the overcharges were about $5,000 on average per class member. But even trebled, et cetera, the maximum recovery were between 13 and 23, I think it was. It might have been $30,000. And it tried to bring a national class action on behalf of all the small merchants for this antitrust violation. And the Second Circuit, based on evidence, the restaurant put in evidence that showed to prove an antitrust claim, you had to prove the market share and the control, and it would cost $500,000 or more to prove it, and no one was going to pursue those claims on an individual basis. If you didn't do it on a class action basis, you couldn't do it. So the Second Circuit said, well, the Supreme Court has long said, we're not going to enforce an arbitration clause where it would prevent you from effectively vindicating your statutory rights. This would have exactly that effect. So we're going to say the arbitration clause is unenforceable, the class action ban is unenforceable, and allow a class action in court against American Express. The Supreme Court took the case and essentially everybody understood what was at stake. If you read our amicus brief posted on our website, if you read the USA's amicus brief, all of them said you have to preserve this effective vindication of rights doctrine or you've eliminated the whole rationale for arbitration. for arbitration and forcing cases into it. And in the decision, the Supreme Court said, we don't care. Justice Scalia's decision focused on two things. First, it said they agreed to this arbitration clause, and agreement is critically important. And second, basically, this basically throwing out the effective vindication of rights doctrine, Scalia drew a distinction and said, look, all we are preserving is the right to pursue your claim. And they're still there. The restaurants could still pursue their claim. If they can't afford that, that's a separate issue. That's not anything the arbitration clause is putting there in their way. They still have the right to pursue their claims. They just don't have a right to enforce their claims if they can't afford to. Basically, pulled out of the whole idea of effective vindication of statutory rights, the word effective, and said, well, as long as they theoretically have the possibility of vindicating their rights, that's good enough. And we are going to enforce the arbitration clause. To make clear how fundamental this was, Justice Kagan's dissent did not pull punches. It called this a betrayal of our arbitration doctrine, which it was, not a soft word. It said, an arbitration clause throughout the majority disregards our decision's central tenet. An arbitration clause may not thwart federal law, irrespective of exactly how it does it. But, of course, now the majority was saying, yes, it could. And Kagan also pointed out what she felt was driving the majority, which is, to a hammer, everything looks like a nail, and to a court bent on diminishing the usefulness of Rule 23, which is the federal rule authorizing class action, everything looks like a class action ready to be dismantled. A bit of scary inside baseball that justices directly involved in the discussion are saying the majority is bent on destroying the utility of class action. But what the Supreme Court held, and particularly what Scalia said, is the FAA essentially trumps not only antitrust laws, but all the substantive federal laws. Where an arbitration clause is in there and bans class action, and the enforcement of that clause and the class action ban would allow a company to violate the federal antitrust laws or any other federal law and simply walk away with the money, we, the court, will enforce that arbitration clause anyway. So the FAA trumps not only the antitrust laws, but all federal laws. There's no exception unless, Scalia pointed out, Congress had explicitly said that that law would not allow cases to be forced in arbitration or would not allow class action to be banned. But, of course, almost no federal statute says that. And, of course, the FAA doesn't say that. The FAA was passed in the 1920s. But the FAA, the court held, didn't just trump all the federal substantive laws, unless there's exceptions made. It trumps Rule 23, the federal rule in creating class actions itself. If you want to really focus on where Scalia underscores all this, look at footnote 5 in his decision. The dissent ignores what he says AT&T Mobility established. The FAA's command to enforce arbitration agreement trumps any interest, any interest in ensuring the prosecution of low-value claims. Since the central value of class actions for damages is to allow the prosecution of low-damage claims, he's basically saying the FAA allows that to be entirely wiped out. And, of course, it says AT&T Mobility versus Concepcion allows them to wipe out state law substantive claims as well. The result, corporations have a license to steal. The damages at stake in this case, the case alleged there was $16 billion stolen in violation of the antitrust laws by American Express. And to show you that this is not just, an imaginary number, several months ago, Visa and MasterCard announced that they were settling similar claims for over $6 billion. But as a result of this decision, American Express simply walks away with the money, and nobody does anything about it. A federal law passed in 1923 to facilitate arbitration and access to justice between businesses is now being used to enforce arbitration clauses imposed by corporations on smaller businesses, consumers, and workers to eliminate their access to justice. And a law that's being was passed to ensure the courts would not be biased against arbitration is now being used to make courts biased in favor of arbitration. If you take a look again at footnote 5 of Scalia's decision, it says the FAA, contrary to the dissent's assertion, favors the absence of litigation when that is the consequence of a class action waiver. Since the law was entirely passed to put litigation on arbitration on even footing, to suggest that somehow the FAA favors the absence of litigation is a truly scary proposition. And it suggests the Federal Arbitration Act should be renamed the Corporate Immunity Act. So what's next? Well, first, I can tell you that the Italian Colors restaurant, in homage to the decision, has created a new drink. The Supreme Court decision, inspired by Justice Scalia, is listed on its menu, which has bourbon, a dash of bitters, and Sinar liquid, which is a very bitter Italian liqueur. And the restaurant notes, American Express will not be accepted for payment for this drink. But beyond that, so what's next? First, Congress could undo this by passing the Arbitration Fairness Act, but that doesn't look likely anytime real soon. The regulatory agencies, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, is authorized to bar arbitration and class action bans in the financial services industry if a study convinces it that it is denying access to justice. And so we are hoping and working very hard to try to make sure that the CFPB will do that. The SEC also has the regulatory authority to bar the use of class action bans and arbitration clauses in the securities industry, and hopefully that will happen. But in the meantime, in terms of what's next, the defendants will do what any rational profit-maximizing group would do under these circumstances. They will try to deny access to justice to more and more of their customers and workers. They will put arbitration clauses and class action bans in more and more agreements. They will try to apply them to more transactions, to more interactions, to products and people. You're going to see those first, in more places where we already have arguably agreements or even clear agreements. You buy a car, you sign an agreement. Personally, you can anticipate seeing arbitration clauses, class action bans going to claims in car sales, from insurers, antitrust, securities, any financial transaction, as well as more and more product purchases. You'll see them in places not only where there is an agreement now, but where there's no agreement now. You can anticipate starting to see them not only in everything on the Internet, but in printing on tickets that you buy to get into places, on the sides of products, in owner's manuals. For example, Hyundai has just put in its owner's manual that you are waiving breach of warranty claims, the ability to litigate breach of warranty claims, and you have to put them in arbitration. You will see them extended to more and more claims. They're going to be coming to try to force civil rights claims into court, to force personal injury claims into court. If you look at where class actions are being brought now and the claims being asserted in class actions now, you can expect to see an attempt to apply arbitration and class action bans to all of those claims in the future. As a result, and a bunch of those clauses will be enforced. And as a result, you will see far more violations of the law, far more take place, you'll see far more of them go unremedied, and you will see ultimately billions stolen without recourse. In the meantime, to be clear what's next, the plaintiffs are still going to have access in many circumstances, and they're going to keep fighting. So you'll have access to justice where there is no contract or an agreement or no arbitration clause or class action ban in agreement. You'll have access where the contracts are poorly drafted So the arbitration clause is in there, but it overreaches too much, or it's one-sided, or it strips you of your rights, or it creates ridiculous, unreasonable barriers to arbitration. It says you can do arbitration only if you pay $1 million for your individual arbitration, or you have to go to, you know, Alaska to arbitration your claim. Plaintiff's lawyers will be able to argue still that defendants have waived their defense in certain cases, and they'll develop attacks on the formation of the contract itself, because that is an avenue Justice Thomas suggested in AT&T Concepcion might bear fruit. You're also going to see more private attorneys general's actions, because the theory of those actions is that you're suing for the public or the government. You are not suing on behalf of a class, but you're protecting other people's rights. You're also going to see more actual attorney general's actions. The case called EEOC versus Waffle House, the Supreme Court held that an arbitration clause didn't bar the government from bringing a case because they were not a party to the arbitration clause. You're going to see more of that, more than that. You're going to see attacks on the Supreme Court's basic premise that, hey, these people agreed to this, because we all know they don't really agree to anything like that. Waivers of their rights. And you're going to see constitutional attacks eventually, I believe, on the Federal Arbitration Act itself as interpreted by the court. The courts are going to have to deal with all of the above. The Supreme Court, in the meantime, I believe, is going to continue to expand arbitration and federal preemption and continue to limit class action. And the Supreme Court, to be clear, we're focused on the American Express case here, but this is part of a much larger trend. Take a look, for example, at the Bartlett decision allowing generic drug manufacturers to avoid liability for design defect claims, and, as they've already been about, allowed to avoid liability for failure to warn of their drug dangers. There is a widespread limitation effort going on by the Supreme Court on access to justice, which this is a huge part of, but still only a part of. And as access justice continues to decrease, what you're going to see is injustice increasing, rights violated with no remedy at all, and hopefully eventually backlash as the public and the rest of the government understands the Supreme Court has gone too far. But in the meantime, that's what's next.
Happy to take questions.
Sure.
Yep. I received a question over email, and I'll get to that. And then after the board, we'll take questions from people on the call. So the first question is, as the plaintiffs in American Express were businesses rather than individual consumers, do you think this had any weight in the court finding that the arbitration agreement was valid under the FAA? And do you think that since small businesses are being affected by arbitration agreements, do you think Congress is now more likely to act?
Well, I think the answer to the first question is no, I don't think the fact that they were small businesses made any difference to the Supreme Court. We were hopeful, in fact, the plaintiffs were hopeful, that that might make the Supreme Court less likely to enforce the arbitration clause because the Supreme Court might be more concerned about affecting the rights of small businesses than they have seemed to be about affecting the rights of consumers. That also affected their choice of counsel. They brought in Paul Clement to argue the case, and it made everybody was sort of stunned at how none of it made any difference. The court, I think, would not draw any different line in terms of consumers. It would be that these are still enforceable. Yes, I think the fact that it affects small businesses may make a difference in Congress. Whether it will make enough of a difference, we will have to see.
All right, thank you. And if you have any questions for Arthur, I believe the operator will give you instructions on how to get those questions through.
Yes, thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing *1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, press *1 to ask a question, and we'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal.
And actually, while we're waiting, Arthur, would you mind talking about the cases coming up next term, which might affect arbitration and what the likely outcomes will be?
I'm sorry, I'm really not ready to do that. Sorry.
That's fine. We do have questions in the queue, so maybe we'll go to those.
And we'll take our first question from Jessica Spivak. Please go ahead.
I just had a question for you. Why do you think Congress isn't going to pass the Anti-Arbitration Act, and what do you think can be done to help them try to pass laws such as this?
Well, I think for a long time, the word we were getting back, and to be clear, public justice doesn't do any lobbying, so I'm not
informed
about this, but the word we're getting back is that Congress didn't see this as an issue that most people cared about. They didn't even see it as an issue that the civil rights community cared about, the women's rights groups cared about, that they sort of viewed it as a small issue. What I think this decision has done is tee it up in a much bigger way. The civil rights groups are coming out about it, furious because they see how it's affecting people throughout the country, and including their ability to assert their civil rights claims. But I think the larger problem in getting it through Congress has been it's hard to overstate the level of corporate influence in Congress and dollars.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look, this is, I don't have to criticize anybody's morals or integrity. If you are a corporation whose focus is on maximizing profits, then you want to increase your income and decrease your expenditures. And anybody brings a lawsuit against you, much less a class action lawsuit against you, even if it's not meritorious, that's an expenditure. If it is meritorious, it's a way bigger expenditure, and it deters you from bringing in income that you could otherwise get, including by getting close to the law or even breaking the law if you think, you know, there's enough profit. So any rational, you know, profit-maximizing corporation would absolutely want to force cases out of court and into arbitration and ban class action.
Mm-hmm.
And then with more and more money, it's more and more campaign contributions and more lobbyists and more power to make a difference in Congress. Not that they're going to paint it this way to Congress. They're going to talk about the meddlesome federal government and, you know, frivolous lawsuits and greedy lawyers, the same propaganda campaign you've been hearing for a long time. But it is, those are the cards they're going to play, but all in the interest to eliminate people's rights. And just, you know, as an example, when you try to get press about bringing a lawsuit, what gets the press is that you filed the lawsuit, it's that you got a decision in the lawsuit, you got a jury verdict or a ruling. If you can't file the lawsuit to begin with, what's the press going to even write about? So it becomes a very difficult job, and what ultimately has to happen is enough violations of the law get exposed and enough people get angry and enough outrageous things happen that things turn around, sort of like what happened with the financial crisis and the Dodd-Frank Act, authorizing the regulatory agency, the CFPB, to bar this, but we'll see how it goes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, thank you. If you have any other questions, just please press star 1.
Take our next question from Jed Schwartz. Please go ahead.
Hi. I caught I missed the first 10 minutes of this presentation. I'm not really familiar with the case, and I'm not a lawyer, but I am interested in corporate accountability. Can you, and since I'm the last, since this is the last question or one of a few questions and you have a little bit of time, can you briefly sketch some of the ongoing implications for the stability of the U.S. society and the economy of this decision? Is that a fair question?
Sure.
Thanks.
Basically, we are in a society in which more and more the economy is being run on a mass transaction basis. Less and less are people going to their neighborhood stores and individually purchasing things from people they know well. People are increasingly buying things on the internet, going to stores that have similar stores all around the country, whether it's Target or you name it. They're using credit cards on the net to buy things. They're working with one of five or six phone companies. It's all being done through mass transactions. And a huge amount, particularly of the financial transactions, are small dollar amounts. Now, historically, the way that you get access to justice and the ability to hold corporations accountable when they cheat you out of money, when they violate the law, when they violate their rights, when it does involve small dollar amounts, no one is going to go to court, you know, over $30 or even $100 or even a couple $100. And particularly when they're doing mass transactions for the companies, if you're doing business with 5 million customers and you can take $100 from each of them, you know, we're talking about enormous $500 million with one violation of the law. And the question is, what deters the companies from doing that? And the answer is, of course, some government law enforcement, but the rest is what our legal system developed was class action. So you could bring a class action on behalf of all those people who had the $100 taken them, all 5 million, in one case, and hold the company accountable. And what the Supreme Court has basically just said is that company can now include in its so-called agreement with you, that is, in the piece of paper, that is the thing you check on the website to see the website, the piece of paper they send you after you've purchased the credit card or in the bill stuffer, things like that, they can put in there a clause that says, you hereby agree that you cannot sue us in court, that you can only seek to enforce your rights against us in a one-on-one arbitration against us, and you cannot bring or participate in the class action against us, which effectively means that you are not going to sue them at all. AT&T actually had an arbitration system in place, the one the Supreme Court said was such a favorable for plaintiffs. We did discovery in a case called Tonis versus AT&T, got access to all the documents, and the judge found on the basis of the evidence that an infinitesimal number of consumers even tried to use the arbitration process because of the small dollar amount, even though AT&T was taking millions by breaking the law. And so the implications of this decision are that corporations all throughout America now have a license to steal. Will some of them hopefully not steal? Sure. Will some of them steal? Absolutely. You know, they'd be crazy not to in terms of maximizing their profits and limiting their expenditures. It comes down to their morals. And I would love to think that the morality of all these corporations is going to stop it. But the reason we have a legal system is because we can't rely on people or individuals' morals. We got to enforce the law. What this has done is basically given corporations the power to use arbitration clauses and class action bans to wipe out any enforcement of tons of laws against them, particularly where small dollar transactions.
Well, I want to thank you for that answer. And if there are no more questions, I'd like to thank everybody for joining today's call. And a special thank you once again to Arthur for your insights and your time. Have a great day, everybody.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude today's conference. We thank you for your participation.